England. Something might have had time to grow there in the interval. On the continent, their standards were declining, but perhaps again the island might be their prey. It was, says Hodgkin, in his admirable account, a hungry monster which turned to England for food as well as plunder. A group of pagan ruffians and pirates had gained possession of an effective military and naval machine, but they faced a mass of formidable veterans whom they had to feed and manage, and for whom they must provide killings. Such men make plans, and certainly their descent upon England was one of the most carefully considered and elaborately prepared villainies of that dark time. Guthrum died in 891, and the pact which he'd sworn with Alfred, and loosely kept, ended. Suddenly, in the autumn of 892, a hostile armada of 250 ships appeared off Lym, carrying to the invasion of England the great heathen army that had ravaged France. They disembarked and fortified themselves at Appledore on the edge of the forest. They were followed by 80 ships conveying a second force of baffled raiders from the continent, who sailed up the Thames and established themselves on its southern bank at Milton near Sittingbourne. Thus, Kent was to be attacked from both sides. This immense, concerted assault confronted Alfred with his third struggle for life. The English, as we may call them, for the Mercians and West Saxons stood together, had secured 14 years of unquiet peace in which to develop their defences. Many of the southern towns were fortified. They were burhs. The Firth had been improved in organisation, though its essential weakness had not been removed. There had been a regathering of wealth and food. There was a settled administration, and the allegiance of all was given to King Alfred. Unlike Charlemagne, he had a valiant son. At 22, Edward could lead his father's armies to the field. The Mercians also had produced an Ethelred, who was a fit companion to the West Saxon prince. The king, in ill health, is not often seen in this phase at the head of armies. We have glimpses of him, but the great episodes of the war were centred, as they should be, upon the young leaders. The English beat the Vikings in this third war. Owning the command of the sea, the invaders gripped the Kentish Peninsula from the north and south. Alfred had tried to buy them off, and certainly delayed their full attack. He persuaded Heisten, the Viking leader, at least to have his two young sons baptized. He gave Heisten much money, and oaths of peace were interchanged, only to be broken. Meanwhile, the Danes raided mercilessly, and Alfred tried to rouse England to action. In 893, a third expedition, composed of the Danish veterans who settled in Northumbria and East Anglia, sailed round the south coast and, landing, laid siege to Exeter. But now the young leaders struck hard. Apparently they had a strong mounted force, not indeed what we should call cavalry, but possessing swiftness of movement. They fell upon a column of the raiders near the modern Aldershot, routed them, and pursued them for 20 miles till they were glad to swim the Thames and shelter behind the Colne. Unhappily, the army of the young princes was not strong enough to resume the attack, and also it had run out of provisions. The pursuit, therefore, had to be abandoned, and the enemy escaped. The Danes had fortified themselves at Benfleet on the Thames below London, and it's said that their earthworks can be traced to this day. Thence, after recovering from their defeat, they sallied forth to plunder, leaving a moderate garrison in their stronghold. This, the princes, now assaulted. It had very rarely been possible in these wars to storm a well-fortified place, but Alfred's son and his son-in-law, with a strong army from London, fell upon Benfleet and put the army to flight, stormed the fort, and took all that there was within, goods as well as women and children, and brought all to London. And all the ships they either broke in pieces, or burnt, or brought to London or Rochester. Such are the words of the Saxon Chronicle. When, in the 19th century, a railway was being made across this ground, the charred fragments of the ships and numbers of skeletons were unearthed upon the site of Benfleet. In the captured stronghold, the victors found Heisten's wife and his two sons. These were precious hostages, and King Alfred was much criticised at the time, and also later, because he restored them to Heiston. He sent back his wife on broad grounds of humanity. As for the two sons, they'd been baptised. He was godfather to one of them, and Ethelred of Mercia to the other. They were therefore Christian brethren, and the king protected them from the consequences of their father's wrongful war. The 9th century found it very hard to understand this behaviour when the kingdom was fighting desperately against brutal marauders, but that is one of the reasons why in the aftertime the king is called Alfred the Great. The war went on, but so far as the records show, Heiston never fought again. It may be that mercy and chivalry were not in vain. In this cruel war, the Vikings used their three armies. The Grand Army that Heiston had brought from the continent, the army which had landed near Lym, and the third from the Danelaw. But in the end, they were fairly beaten in full and long fight by the Christians from Mercia, Wessex, and Wales. One other incident deserves to be noticed. The Saxon Chronicle says, "Before the winter, the winter of AD 894-5, the Danes towed their ships up the Thames and then up the Lee, and made a fort 20 miles above London Burr. In the autumn, 895, the king camped close to the Burr while they reaped their corn, so that the Danes might not deprive them of the crop. Then one day the king rode up by the river and looked at a place where it might be obstructed, so that they could not bring their ships out. He made two forts on the two sides of the river. Then the army perceived that they could not bring their ships out. Therefore, they left them and went across country, and the men of London Burr fetched the ships, and all that they could not take away, they broke up, and all that were worth taking, they brought into London Burr." In 896, the war petered out, and the Vikings, whose strength seemed at this time to be in decline, dispersed, some settling in the Danelaw, some going back to France. "By God's mercy," exclaims the Chronicle in summing up the war, "the Danish army had not too much afflicted the English people." Alfred had well defended the island home. He had, by policy and arms, preserved the Christian civilization in England. He had built up the strength of that mighty south, which has ever since sustained much of the weight of Britain, and later of her empire. He had liberated London, and happily he left behind him descendants who, for several generations, as we shall see, carried his work forward with valour and success. Alfred died in 899, but the struggle with the Vikings had yet to pass through strangely contrasted phases. Alfred's blood gave the English a series of great rulers, and while his inspiration held, victory did not quit the Christian ranks. In his son Edward, who was immediately acclaimed king, the armies had already found a redoubtable leader. A quarrel arose between Edward and his cousin Ethelwald, who fled to the Danelaw and aroused the Vikings of Northumbria and East Anglia to a renewed inroad upon his native land. In 902, Ethelwald and the Danish king crossed the upper reaches of the Thames at Cricklade and ravaged part of Wiltshire. Edward, in retaliation, ordered the invasion of East Anglia, with an army formed of the men of Kent and London. They devastated Middle Anglia. But the Kentish contingent, being slow to withdraw, was overtaken and brought to battle by the infuriated Danes. The Danes were victorious and made a great slaughter. But, as fate would have it, both Eric, the Danish king, and the renegade Ethelwald perished on the field, and the new king, Guthrum II, made peace with Edward on the basis of Alfred's treaty of 886, but with additions which show that the situation had changed. It is now assumed that the Danes are Christians and will pay their tithes, while the parish priest is to be fined if he misleads his flock as to the time of a feast day or a festival. In 910 this treaty was broken by the Danes, and the war was renewed in Mercia. The main forces of Wessex and Kent had already been sent by Edward, who was with the fleet, to the aid of the Mercians, and in heavy fighting at Tettenhall in Staffordshire, the Danes were decisively defeated. This English victory was a milestone in a long conflict. The Danish armies in Northumbria never recovered from the battle, and the Danish Midlands and East Anglia thus lay open to English conquest. Up to this point, Mercia and Wessex had been the defenders, often reduced to the most grievous straits. But now the tide had turned. Fear camped with the Danes. Edward's sister had been, as we have seen, married to Earl Ethelred of Mercia. Ethelred died in 911, and his widow, Ethelfleda, succeeded and surpassed him. In those savage times, the emergence of a woman ruler was enough to betoken her possession of extraordinary qualities. Edward the Elder, as he was afterwards called, and his sister, the Lady of the Mercians, conducted the national war in common, and carried its success to heights which Alfred never knew. The policy of the two kingdoms, thus knit by blood and need, marched in perfect harmony, and the next onslaught of the Danes was met with confident alacrity and soon broken. The victors then set themselves deliberately to the complete conquest of the Danelaw and its five boroughs. This task occupied the next 10 years, brother and sister advancing in concert upon their respective lines, and fortifying towns they took at every stage. In 917, when Edward stormed Tempsford near Bedford, and King Guthrum was killed, the whole resistance of East Anglia collapsed, and all the Danish leaders submitted to Edward as their protector and lord. They were granted in return their estates and the right to live according to their Danish customs. At the same time, the Lady of the Mercians conquered Leicester, and received even from York offers of submission. In this hour of success, Ethelfleda died, and Edward, hastening to Tamworth, was invited by the nobles of Mercia to occupy the vacant throne. Alfred's son was now undisputed king of all England south of the Humber, and the British princes of North and South Wales hastened to offer their perpetual allegiance. Driving northwards in the next 2 years, Edward built forts at Manchester, at Thelwall in Cheshire, and at Bakewell in the Peak Country. The Danes of Northumbria saw their end approaching. It seemed as if a broad and lasting unity was about to be reached. Edward the Elder reigned 5 years more in triumphant peace, and when he died in 924, his authority and his gifts passed to a third remarkable sovereign, capable in every way of carrying on the work of his father and grandfather. Chapter 8. The Saxon Dusk. Athelstan, the third of the great West Saxon kings, sought at first, in accordance with the traditions of his house, peaceful relations with the unconquered parts of the Danelaw. But upon disputes arising, he marched into Yorkshire in 926, and there established himself. Northumbria submitted. The kings of the Scots and of Strathclyde acknowledged him as their father and lord, and the Welsh princes agreed to pay tribute. There was an uneasy interlude. Then in 933 came a campaign against the Scots, and in 937 a general rebellion and renewed war organized by all the hitherto defeated characters in the drama. The whole of North Britain, Celtic, Danish and Norwegian, pagan and Christian, together presented a hostile front under Constantine, King of the Scots, and Olaf of Dublin, with Viking reinforcements from Norway. On this occasion, neither life nor time was wasted in manoeuvres. The fight that followed is recorded for us in an Icelandic saga and an English poem. According to the saga man, Athelstan challenged his foes to meet him in a pitched battle, and to this they blithely agreed. The English king even suggested the place where all should be put to the test. The armies, very large for those impoverished times, took up their stations as if for the Olympic Games, and much parleying accompanied the process. Tempers rose high as these masses of manhood flaunted their shields and blades at one another and flung their gibes across a narrow space. And there was presently a fierce clash between the Northumbrian and Icelandic Vikings on the one hand, and a part of the English army on the other. In this, although the Northumbrian commander fled, the English were worsted. But on the following day, the real trial of strength was staged. The rival hosts paraded in all the pomp of war, and then in hearty goodwill fell on with spear, axe, and sword. All day long the battle raged. The original victory song on Brunnenbach opens to us a view of the Anglo-Saxon mind with its primitive imagery and war delight. Here, Athelstan, king of earls, the lord, the giver of the bracelets of nobles, and his brother also Edmund the Eithling, an age-long glory won by slaughter in battle with the edges of swords at Brunnenbach. The wall of shields they cleaved, they hewed the battle shafts with hammered weapons. The foe flinched, the Scottish people and the ship fleet, the field was coloured with the warrior's blood. After that, the sun on high, the greatest star, glided over the earth, God's candle bright, till the noble creature hastened to her setting. There lay soldiers, many with darts struck down, northern men over their shields shot. So were the Scotch, weary of battle they had had their fill. They left behind them to feast on carrion, the dusty-coated raven with horned beak, the black-coated eagle with white tail, the greedy battle-hawk, and the grey beast, the wolf in the wood. The victory of the English was overwhelming. Constantine, the perjured, as the victors claimed, fled back to the north, and Olaf retired with his remnants to Dublin. Thus did King Alfred's grandson, the valiant Athelstan, become one of the first sovereigns of Western Europe. He styled himself on coin and charter Rex Totius Britanniae. These claims were accepted upon the continent. His three sisters were wedded respectively to the Carolingian king Charles the Simple, to the Capetian Hugh the Great, and to Otto the Saxon, a future Holy Roman Emperor. He even installed a Norwegian prince who swore allegiance and was baptized as his vassal at York. Here again one might hope that a decision in the long quarrel had been reached. Yet it persisted. And when Athelstan died 2 years after Brunnenbach and was succeeded by his half-brother, a youth of 18, the beaten forces welled up once more against him. Edmund, in the spirit of his race, held his own. He reigned only 6 years, but when he died in 946, he'd not ceded an inch or an ell. Edmund was succeeded by his brother Edred, the younger son of Alfred's son, Edward the Elder. He too maintained the realm against all comers, and, beating them down by force of arms, seemed to have quenched forever the rebellious fires of Northumbria. Historians select the year 954 as the end of the first great episode in the Viking history of England. 120 years had passed since the impact of the Vikings had smitten the island. For 40 years, English Christian society had struggled for life. For 80 years, 5 warrior kings, Alfred, Edward, Athelstan, Edmund, and Edred, defeated the invaders. The English rule was now restored, though in a form changed by the passage of time, over the whole country. Yet underneath it, there had grown up, deeply rooted in the soil, a Danish settlement covering the great eastern plain, in which Danish blood and Danish customs survived under the authority of the English king. In the brilliant and peaceful reign of Edgar, all this long building had reached its culmination. The reconquest of England was accompanied step by step by a conscious administrative reconstruction, which has governed the development of English institutions from that day to this. The shires were reorganized, each with its sheriff or reeve, a royal officer directly responsible to the crown. The hundreds, subdivisions of the shires, were created, and the towns prepared for defense. An elaborate system of shire, hundred, and borough courts maintained law and order and pursued criminals. Taxation was reassessed. Finally, with this military and political revival, marched a great rebirth of monastic life and learning, and the beginning of our native English literature. The movement was slow and English in origin, but advanced with great strides from the middle of the century as it came in contact with the religious revival on the continent. The work of Dunstan, Archbishop of Canterbury, and his younger contemporaries, Oswald, Bishop of Worcester, and Ethelwold, Bishop of Winchester, was to revive the strict observance of religion within the monasteries, and thereby indirectly to reform the episcopate as more and more monks were elected to bishoprics. Another and happy, if incidental, result was to promote learning and the production of splendid illuminated manuscripts, which were much in demand in contemporary Europe. Many of these, designed for the religious instruction of the laity, were written in English. The Catholic homilies of Elfric, abbot of Aynsham, mark, we are told, the first achievement of English as a literary language, the earliest vernacular to reach this eminence in the whole of Europe. From whatever point of view we regard it, the 10th century is a decisive step forward in the destinies of England. Despite the catastrophic decline of the monarchy which followed the death of Edgar, this organisation and English culture were so firmly rooted as to survive two foreign conquests in less than a century. It must have seemed to contemporaries that with the magnificent coronation at Bath in 973, on which all coronation orders since have been based, the seal was set on the unity of the realm. Everywhere the courts are sitting regularly, in shire and borough and hundred. There is one coinage and one system of weights and measures. The arts of building and decoration are reviving. Learning begins to flourish again in the church. There is a literary language, a king's English, which all educated men write. Civilization has been restored to the island. But now the political fabric which nurtured it was about to be overthrown. Hitherto, strong men armed had kept the house. Now a child, a weakling, a vacillator, a faithless, feckless creature succeeded to the warrior throne. 25 years of peace lapped the island, and the English, so magnificent in stress and danger, so invincible under valiant leadership, relaxed under its softening influences. We've reached the days of Ethelred the Unready. But this expression, which conveys a truth, means literally Ethelred the Ill-Counseled, or Ethelred the Redeless. In 980, serious raids began again. Chester was ravaged from Ireland. The people of Southampton were massacred by marauders from Scandinavia or Denmark. Thanet, Cornwall and Devon all suffered butchery and pillage. We have an epic poem upon the Battle of Maldon, fought in 991. The Danes were drawn up on Northey Island, east of Maldon, with the English facing them from the south bank of the Blackwater estuary. The battle turned upon the causeway joining Northey to the mainland, which was flooded at high tide. The Vikings bargained in their characteristic fashion. "Send quickly, rings for your safety. It is better for you to buy off with tribute this storm of spears than that we should share the bitter war. We will with gold set up a truce. We will go abroad with a tribute and sail the sea and be at peace with you." But Beartnoth, alderman of Essex, replied, "Hearest thou, rover, what this people saith? They will give you in tribute spears and deadly darts and old swords. Here stands an earl, not mean, with his company, who will defend this land, Ethelred's home, my prince's folk and field. The heathen shall fall in the war. Too shameful it seems to me that ye should go abroad with our tribute, unfought with, now that you've come thus far into our land. Not so lightly shall ye come by the treasure. Point and edge shall first make atonement. Grim war-play before we pay tribute." These high words were not made good by the event. As the tide was running out while these taunts were being exchanged, the causeway was now exposed, and the English naively agreed to let the Vikings cross and form on the south bank in order that the battle might be fairly drawn. No sooner had it begun than the English were worsted. Many of Beartnoth's men took to flight, but a group of his thanes, knowing that all was lost, fought on to the death. Then followed the most shameful period of Danegeld. We have seen that Alfred in his day had never hesitated to use money as well as arms. Ethelred used money instead of arms. He used it in ever-increasing quantities with ever-diminishing returns. He paid as a bribe in 991 £22,000 of gold and silver, with rations for the invaders. In 994, with £16,000, he gained not only a brief respite, but the baptism of the raider Olaf, thrown in as a compliment. In 1002, he bought a further truce for £24,000 of silver, but on this occasion he was himself to break it. In their ruin and decay, the English had taken large numbers of Danish mercenaries into their service. Ethelred suspected these dangerous helpers of a plot against his life. Panic-stricken, he planned the slaughter of all Danes in the south of England, whether in his pay or living peaceably on the land. This atrocious design was executed in 1002 on St. Brice's Day. Among the victims was Gunhild, the wife of one of the principal Vikings and sister of Sweyn, king of Denmark. Sweyn swore implacable revenge, and for 2 years executed it upon the wretched islanders. Exeter, Wilton, Norwich, and Thetford all record massacres, which show how widely the retaliation was applied. The fury of the avenger was not slaked by blood. It was baffled, but only for a space, by famine. The Danish army could no longer subsist in the ruined land, and departed in 1005 to Denmark. But the annals of 1006 show that Sweyn was back again, ravaging Kent, sacking Reading and Wallingford. At last, Ethelred, for £36,000 of silver, the equivalent of 3 or 4 years' national income, bought another short-lived truce. A desperate effort was now made to build a fleet. In the energy of despair, which had once inflamed the Carthaginians to their last effort, an immense number of vessels were constructed by the poor, broken people, starving and pillaged to the bone. The new fleet was assembled at Sandwich in 1009. But, says the chronicle, we had not the good fortune nor the worthiness that the ship force could be of any use to this land. Its leaders quarrelled. Some ships were sunk in the fighting, others were lost in a storm, and the rest were shamefully abandoned by the naval commanders. And then afterwards, the people who were in the ships brought them to London, and they let the whole nation's toil thus lightly pass away. There is the record of a final payment to the Vikings in 1012. This time, £48,000 weight of silver was exacted, and the oppressors enforced the collection by the sack of Canterbury, holding Archbishop Alphege to ransom and finally killing him at Greenwich because he refused to coerce his flock to raise the money. The chronicle states, "All these calamities fell upon us through evil counsel, because tribute was not offered to them at the right time, nor yet were they resisted. But when they had done the most evil, then was peace made with them. And notwithstanding all this peace and tribute, they went everywhere in companies, harried our wretched people, and slew them." It is vain to recount further the catalogue of miseries. In earlier ages, such horrors remain unknown because unrecorded. Just enough flickering light plays upon this infernal scene to give us the sense of its utter desolation and hopeless wretchedness and cruelty. It suffices to note that in 1013, Sweyn, accompanied by his younger son, Canute, came again to England, subdued the Yorkshire Danes and the five boroughs in the Danelaw, was accepted as overlord of Northumbria and Danish Mercia, sacked Oxford and Winchester in a punitive foray, and, though repulsed from London, was proclaimed King of England, while Ethelred fled for refuge to the Duke of Normandy, whose sister he'd married. On these triumphs, Sweyn died at the beginning of 1014. There was another respite. The English turned again to Ethelred, declaring that no lord was dearer to them than their natural lord, if he would but rule them better than he had done before. But soon the young Danish prince, Canute, set forth to claim the English crown. At this moment, the flame of Alfred's line rose again in Ethelred's son, Edmund, Edmund Ironside, as he was soon called. At 20, he was famous. Although declared a rebel by his father, and acting in complete disobedience to him, he gathered forces, and in a brilliant campaign struck a succession of heavy blows. He gained battles, he relieved London, he contended with every form of treachery. The hearts of all men went out to him. New forces sprang from the ruined land. Ethelred died, and Edmund, last hope of the English, was acclaimed king. In spite of all odds and a heavy defeat, he was strong enough to make a partition of the realm, and then set himself to rally his forces for the renewal of the struggle. But in 1016, at 22 years of age, Edmund Ironside died, and the whole realm abandoned itself to despair. The ecclesiastical aristocracy, which played so great a part in politics, dwelt long upon the prophecies of coming woe ascribed to St. Dunstan. At Southampton, even while Edmund lived, the lay and spiritual chiefs of England agreed to abandon the descendants of Ethelred forever and recognise Canute as king. All resistance, moral and military, collapsed before the Dane. The family of Ethelred was excised from the royal line, and the last sons of the House of Wessex fled into exile. The young Danish prince received this general and abject submission in a good spirit, although a number of bloody acts were required to attain and secure his position. He made good his promise to fulfil the duties of a king both in spiritual and temporal affairs to the whole country. The English magnates agreed to buy off the Danish army with a huge indemnity, and the new king, in an oath of his soul, endorsed by his chiefs, bound himself to rule for all. Such was the compact solemnly signed by the English and Danish leaders. The kingly house, as Ranke put it, whose right and pre-eminence was connected with the earliest settlements, which had completed the union of the realm and delivered it from the worst distress, was at a moment of moral deterioration and disaster excluded by the spiritual and temporal chiefs of Anglo-Saxon and Danish origin. There were three principles upon which sovereignty could be erected: conquest, which none could dispute, hereditary right, which was greatly respected, and election, which was a kind of compromise between the two. It was upon this last basis that Canute began his reign. It is possible that the early English ideal of kingship and just government in Alfred and Canute was affected by the example of Trajan. This emperor was a favourite of Pope Gregory, who'd sent the first missionaries. There's evidence that stories of Trajan's virtue were read aloud in the English church service. Canute may also have studied, and certainly he reproduced, the poise of the Emperor Augustus. Everyone knows the lesson he administered to his flatterers when he sat on the seashore and forbade the tide to come in. He made a point of submitting himself to the laws whereby he ruled. He even, in his military capacity, subjected himself to the regulations of his own household troops. At the earliest moment, he disbanded his great Danish army and trusted himself broadly to the loyalty of the humbled English. He married Emma of Normandy, the widow of Ethelred, and so forestalled any action by the Duke of Normandy on behalf of her descendants by Ethelred. Canute became the ruling sovereign of the North, and was reckoned as having five or six kingdoms under him. He was already King of Denmark when he conquered England, and he made good his claim to be King of Norway. Scotland offered him its homage. The Viking power, although already undermined, still stretched across the world, ranging from Norway to North America, and through the Baltic to the East. But of all his realms, Canute chose England for his home and capital. He liked, we are told, the Anglo-Saxon way of life. He wished to be considered the successor of Edgar, whose 17 years of peace still shone by contrast with succeeding times. He ruled according to the laws, and he made it known that these were to be administered in austere detachment from his executive authority. He built churches, he professed high devotion to the Christian faith and to the papal diadem. He honoured the memory of St. Edmund and St. Alphege, whom his fellow countrymen had murdered, and brought their relics with pious pomp to Canterbury. From Rome, as a pilgrim, in 1027, he wrote a letter to his subjects, couched in exalted and generous terms, promising to administer equal justice, and laying particular emphasis upon the payment of church dues. His daughter was married to the Emperor Conrad's eldest son, who ultimately carried his empire across Schleswig to the banks of the Eider. These remarkable achievements, under the blessing of God and the smiles of fortune, were in large measure due to his own personal qualities. Here again we see the power of a great man to bring order out of ceaseless broils, and command harmony and unity to be his servants, and how the lack of such men has to be paid for by the inestimable suffering of the many. Some early records of Canute throw a vivid light upon his character and moods. When he entered monasteries and was received with great honour, he proceeded humbly, keeping his eyes fixed with a wonderful reverence on the ground and, shedding tears copiously, nay, I may say, in rivers, he devoutly sought the intervention of the saints. But when it came to making his royal oblations, oh, how often did he fix his weeping eyes upon the earth! How often did he beat that noble breast! What sighs he gave! How often he prayed that he might not be unworthy of clemency from on high! But this, from a saga 2 centuries later, is in a different vein. When King Canute and the Earl Ulf had played a while, the king made a false move, at which the earl took a knight from the king. But the king set the piece again upon the board, and told the earl to make another move. But the earl grew angry, threw over the chessboard, stood up, and went away. The king said, "Run away, Ulf the Fearful." The earl turned round at the door and said, "Thou didst not call me Ulf the Fearful at Helga River, when I hastened to thy help while the Swedes were beating thee like a dog." The earl then went out and went to bed. The morning after, while the king was putting on his clothes, he said to his footboy, "Go thou to Earl Ulf and kill him." The lad went, was away a while, and then came back. The king said, "Hast thou killed the earl?" "I did not kill him, for he was gone to St. Lucius's church." There was a man called Ivar White, a Norwegian by birth, who was the king's court man and chamberlain. The king said to him, "Go thou and kill the earl." Ivar went to the church and in at the choir, and thrust his sword through the earl, who died on the spot. Then Ivar went to the king with a bloody sword in his hand. The king said, "Hast thou killed the earl?" "I have killed him," said he. "Thou didst well." After the earl was killed, the monks closed the church and locked the doors. When that was told the king, he sent a message to the monks, ordering them to open the church and sing high mass. They did as the king ordered, and when the king came to the church, he bestowed on it great property, so that it had a large domain, by which that place was raised very high, and those lands have since always belonged to it. Meanwhile, across the waters of the English Channel, a new military power was growing up. The Viking settlement founded in Normandy in the early years of the 10th century had become the most vigorous military state in France. In less than 100 years, the sea rovers had transformed themselves into a feudal society. Such records as exist are overlaid by legend. We do not even know whether Rollo, the traditional founder of the Norman state, was a Norwegian, a Dane, or a Swede. Norman history begins with the Treaty of Saint-Clair-sur-Epte, made by Rollo with Charles the Simple, king of the West Franks, which affirmed the suzerainty of the King of France and defined the boundaries of the Duchy of Normandy. In Normandy, a class of knights and nobles arose who held their lands in return for military service and sublet to inferior tenants upon the same basis. The Normans, with their craving for legality and logic, framed a general scheme of society, from which there soon emerged an excellent army. Order was strenuously enforced. No one but the duke might build castles or fortify himself. The court or curia of the duke consisted of his household officials, of dignitaries of the church, and of the more important tenants, who owed him not only military service, but also personal attendance at court. Here the administration was centred. Respect for the decisions and interests of the duke was maintained throughout Normandy by the vicomte, who were not merely collectors of taxes from the ducal estates, but also, in effect, prefects, in close touch with the curia, superintending districts like English counties. The dukes of Normandy created relations with the church which became a model for medieval Europe. They were the protectors and patrons of the monasteries in their domains. They welcomed the religious revival of the 10th century and secured the favour and support of its leaders. But they made sure that bishops and abbots were ducal appointments. It was from this virile and well-organized land that the future rulers of England were to come. Between the years 1028 and 1035, the Viking instincts of Duke Robert of Normandy turned him seriously to plans of invasion. His death and his failure to leave a legitimate heir suspended the project, but only for a while. The figure of Emma, sister of Robert of Normandy, looms large in English history at this time. Ethelred had originally married her from a reasonable desire to supplement his failing armaments by a blood tie with the most vigorous military state in Europe. Canute married her to give him a united England. Of her qualities and conduct, little is known. Nevertheless, few women have stood at the centre of such remarkable converging forces. In fact, Emma had two husbands and two sons who were kings of England. In 1035, Canute died, and his empire with him. He left three sons, two by a former wife and one, Hardy Canute, by Emma. These sons were ignorant and boorish Vikings, and many thoughts were turned to the representatives of the old West Saxon line, Alfred and Edward, sons of Ethelred and Emma, then living in exile in Normandy. The elder, Alfred, the innocent prince, as the chronicler calls him, hastened to England in 1036, ostensibly to visit his again-widowed mother, the ex-queen Emma. A Wessex earl, Godwin, was the leader of the Danish party in England. He possessed great abilities and exercised the highest political influence. The venturesome Alfred was arrested and his personal attendants slaughtered. The unfortunate prince himself was blinded, and in this condition soon ended his days in the monastery at Ely. The guilt of this crime was generally ascribed to Godwin. The succession being thus simplified, Canute's sons divided the paternal inheritance. Swain reigned in Norway for a spell, but his two brothers who ruled England were short-lived, and within 7 years the throne of England was again vacant. Godwin continued to be the leading figure in the land, and was now master of its affairs. There was, still living in exile in Normandy, Edward, the remaining son of Ethelred and Emma, younger brother of the ill-starred Alfred. In these days of reviving anarchy, all men's minds turned to the search for some stable institution. This could only be found in monarchy, and the illustrious line of Alfred the Great possessed unequal claims and titles. It was the Saxon monarchy which for 5 or 6 generations had provided the spearhead of resistance to the Danes. The West Saxon line was the oldest in Europe. 2 generations back, the House of Capet were lords of little more than Paris and the Île-de-France, and the Norman dukes were Viking rovers. A sense of sanctity and awe still attached to any who could claim descent from the great king, and beyond him to Egbert and immemorial antiquity. Godwin saw that he could consolidate his power and combine both English and Danish support by making Edward king. He bargained with the exile, threatening to put a nephew of Canute on the throne unless his terms were met. Of these, the first was the restriction of Norman influence in England. Edward made no difficulty. He was welcomed home and crowned, and for the next 24 years, with one brief interval, England was mainly governed by Godwin and his sons. "He had been to such an extent exalted," says the Chronicle of Florence of Worcester, "as if he had ruled the king and all England." Edward was a quiet, pious person, without liking for war or much aptitude for administration. His Norman upbringing made him the willing, though gentle, agent of Norman influence, so far as Earl Godwin would allow. Norman prelates appeared in the English church, Norman clerks in the royal household, and Norman landowners in the English shires. To make all smooth, Edward was obliged to marry Godwin's young and handsome daughter. But we're assured by contemporary writers that this union was no more than formal. According to tradition, the king was a kindly, weak, chubby albino. Some later writers profess to discern a latent energy in a few of his dealings with the formidable group of Anglo-Danish warriors that surrounded him. Nevertheless, his main interest in life was religious, and as he grew older, his outlook was increasingly that of a monk. In these harsh times, he played much the same part as Henry VI's, whose nature was similar, during the Wars of the Roses. His saintliness brought him, as the years passed by, a reward in the veneration of his people, who forgave him his weakness for the sake of his virtues. Meanwhile, the Godwin family maintained their dictatorship under the crown. Nepotism in those days was not merely the favouring of a man's own family. It was almost the only way in which a ruler could procure trustworthy lieutenants. The family tie, though frequently failing, gave at least the assurance of a certain identity of interest. Statistics had not been collected, but there was a general impression in these primitive times that a man could trust his brother, or his wife's brother, or his son, better than a stranger. We must not therefore hasten to condemn Earl Godwin because he parcelled out the English realm among his relations. Neither must we marvel that other ambitious magnates found a deep cause of complaint in this distribution of power and favour. For some years, a bitter intrigue was carried on between Norman and Anglo-Danish influences at the English court. A crisis came in the year 1051, when the Norman party at court succeeded in driving Godwin into exile. During Godwin's absence, William of Normandy is said to have paid an official visit to the confessor in England in quest of the succession to the crown. Very likely King Edward promised that William should be his heir. But in the following year, Godwin returned, backed by a force raised in Flanders, and with the active help of his son Harold. Together, father and son obliged King Edward to take them back into power. Many of the principal Norman agents in the country were expelled, and the authority of the Godwin family was felt again throughout the land. The territories that they directly controlled stretched south of a line from the Wash to the Bristol Channel. 7 months after his restoration, Godwin died in 1053. Since Canute first raised him to eminence, he'd been 35 years in public life. Harold, his eldest surviving son, succeeded to his father's great estates. He now filled his part to the full, and for the next 13 adventurous years was the virtual ruler of England. In spite of the antagonism of rival Anglo-Danish earls and the opposition of the Norman elements still attached to the Confessor's court, the Godwins, father and son, maintained their rule under what we should now call a constitutional monarchy. A brother of Harold's became Earl of East Anglia, and a third son of Godwin, Tostig, who courted the Normans and was high in the favour of King Edward, received the earldom of Northumbria, dispossessing the earls of those regions. But there was now no unity within the House of Godwin. Harold and Tostig soon became bitter foes. All Harold's competence, vigour and shrewdness were needed to preserve the unity of the realm. Even so, as we shall see, the rift between the brothers left the land a prey to foreign ambitions. The political condition of England at the close of the reign of Edward the Confessor was one of widespread weakness. Illuminated manuscripts, sculpture, metalwork and architecture of much artistic merit were still produced. Religious life flourished, and a basis of sound law and administration remained. But the virtue and vigour of Alfred's posterity were exhausted, and the Saxon monarchy itself was in decline. A strain of feeble princes, most of whom were short-lived, had died without children. Even the descendants of the prolific Ethelred the Unready died out with strange rapidity, and at this moment only a sickly boy and his sister and the aged sovereign represented the warrior dynasty which had beaten the Vikings and reconquered the Danelaw. The great earls were becoming independent in the provinces. Though England was still the only state in Europe with a royal treasury, to which sheriffs all over the country had to account, royal control over the sheriffs had grown lax. The king lived largely upon his private estates and governed as best he could through his household. The remaining powers of the monarchy were in practice severely restricted by a little group of Anglo-Danish notables. The main basis of support for the English kings had always been this select council, never more than 60, who in a vague manner regarded themselves as the representatives of the whole country. It was, in fact, a committee of courtiers, the greater thanes, and ecclesiastics. But at this time, this assembly of wise men in no way embodied the life of the nation. It weakened the royal executive without adding any strength of its own. Its character and quality suffered in the general decay. It tended to fall into the hands of the great families. As the central power declined, a host of local chieftains disputed and intrigued in every county, pursuing private and family aims and knowing no interest but their own. Feuds and disturbances were rife. The people, too, were hampered not only by the many conflicting petty authorities, but by the deep division of custom between the Saxon and the Danish districts. Absurd anomalies and contradictions obstructed the administration of justice. The system of land tenure varied from complete manorial conditions in Wessex to the free communities of the Danelaw in the north and east. There was no defined relation between lordship and land. A thane owed service to the king as a personal duty, and not in respect of lands he held. The island had come to count for little on the continent, and had lost the thread of its own progress. The defences, both of the coast and of the towns, were neglected. To the coming conquerors, the whole system, social, moral, political, and military, seemed effete. The figure of Edward the Confessor comes down to us faint, misty, frail. The medieval legend, carefully fostered by the church whose devoted servant he was, surpassed the man. The lights of Saxon England were going out, and in the gathering darkness a gentle, grey-beard prophet foretold the end. When on his deathbed Edward spoke of a time of evil that was coming upon the land, his inspired mutterings struck terror into the hearers. Only Archbishop Stigand, who had been Godwin's stalwart, remained unmoved, and whispered in Harold's ear that age and sickness had robbed the monarch of his wits. Thus, on January the 5th, 1066, ended the line of the Saxon kings. The national sentiment of the English, soon to be conquered, combined in the bitter period that lay before them with the gratitude of the church to circle the royal memory with a halo. As the years rolled by, his spirit became the object of popular worship. His shrine at Westminster was a centre of pilgrimage. Canonised in 1161, he lived for centuries in the memories of the Saxon folk. The Normans also had an interest in his fame. For them, he was the king by whose wisdom the crown had been left, or so they claimed, to their duke. Hence both sides blessed his memory. And until England appropriated St. George during the Hundred Years' War, St. Edward the Confessor was the kingdom's patron saint. St. George proved undoubtedly more suitable to the islanders' needs, moods, and character. Book 2. The Making of the Nation. Chapter 1. The Norman Invasion. England, distracted by faction and rivalry at home, had for a long time lain under rapacious glare from overseas. The Scandinavians sought to revive the empire of Canute. The Normans claimed that their duke held his cousin Edward's promise of the throne. William of Normandy had a virile origin and a hard career. The prize was large enough for the separate ambitions of both the hungry powers. Their simultaneous action in the opening stages was an advantage to be shared in common. One morning, Duke Robert of Normandy, the fourth descendant of Rollo, was riding towards his capital town, Falaise, when he saw Arlette, daughter of a tanner, washing linen in a stream. His love was instantly fired. He carried her to his castle and, although already married to a lady of quality, lived with her for the rest of his days. To this romantic but irregular union there was born in 1027 a son, William, afterwards famous. Duke Robert died when William was only 7, and in those harsh times a minor's hold upon his inheritance was precarious. The great nobles who were his guardians came one by one to violent ends, and rival ambitions stirred throughout Normandy. Were they to be ruled by a bastard? Was the grandson of a tanner to be the liege lord of the many warrior families? The taint of bastardy clung and sank deep into William's nature. It embittered and hardened him. When, many years afterwards, he besieged the town of Alençon, The citizens imprudently hung out hides upon the walls, shouting, "Hides for the tanner!" William repaid this taunt by devastating the town and mutilating or flaying alive its chief inhabitants. It was the declared policy of King Henry of France to recognise and preserve the minor upon the ducal throne. He became his feudal guardian and overlord. But for this, the boy could hardly have survived. In 1047, when he was 20, a formidable conspiracy was organised against him, and at the outset of the revolt he narrowly missed destruction. The Confederates proposed to divide the duchy among themselves, conferring on one of their number, to whom they took an oath, the nominal title of Duke. William was hunting in the heart of the disaffected country. His seizure was planned, but his fool broke in upon him with a timely warning to fly for his life. By daybreak, he'd ridden 40 miles, and was for the moment safe in loyal Falaise. Knowing that his own strength could not suffice, he rode on ceaselessly to appeal for help to his overlord, the King of France. This was not denied. King Henry took the field. William gathered together his loyal barons and retainers. At the Battle of Vallesdune, fought entirely on both sides by cavalry, the rebels were routed, and thenceforward, for the first time, William's position as Duke of Normandy was secure. There was room enough within the existing social system for feuds, and in some fiefs even for private wars. But when the state fell into the hands of strong overlords, these were kept within bounds, which did not prevent the rapid growth of a martial society, international both in its secular and military principles. The sense of affinity to the liege lord at every stage in the hierarchy, the association of the land with fighting power, the acceptance of the papal authority in spiritual matters, united the steel-clad knights and nobles over an ever-widening area of Europe. To the full acceptance of the universal Christian Church was added the conception of a warrior aristocracy, animated by ideas of chivalry and knit together in a system of military service based upon the holding of land. This institution was accompanied by the rise of mail-clad cavalry to a dominant position in war, and new forces were created which could not only conquer, but rule. In no part of the feudal world was the fighting quality of the new organisation carried to a higher pitch than among the Normans. William was a master of war, and thereby gave his small duchy some of the prestige which England had enjoyed 30 years before under the firm and clear-sighted government of Canute. He and his knights now looked out upon the world with fearless and adventurous eyes. Good reasons for gazing across the Channel were added to the natural ambitions of warlike men. William, like his father, was in close touch with the Saxon court, and had watched every move on the part of the supporters of the Anglo-Danish party, headed by Godwin and his son Harold. Fate played startlingly into the hands of the Norman Duke. On some visit of inspection, probably in 1064, Harold was driven by the winds onto the French coast. The Count of Ponthieu, who held sway there, looked upon all shipwrecked mariners and their gear as treasure trove. He held Harold to ransom for what he was worth, which was much. The contacts between the Norman and English courts were at this time close and friendly, and Duke William asked for the release of King Edward's Thane, acting at first by civil request, and later by armed commands. The Count of Ponthieu reluctantly relinquished his windfall and conducted Harold to the Norman court. A friendship sprang up between William and Harold. Politics apart, they liked each other well. We see them, falcon on wrist, in sport. Harold taking the field with William against the Bretons, or rendering skilful service in hazardous broils. He was honoured and knighted by William. But the Duke looked forward to his future succession to the English crown. Here, indeed, was the prize to be won. Harold had one small streak of royal blood on his mother's side, but William, through his father, had a more pointed, or at least less cloudy, claim to the island throne. This claim he was resolved to assert. He saw the power which Harold wielded under Edward the Confessor, and how easily he might convert it into sovereignty if he happened to be on the spot when the Confessor died. He invited Harold to make a pact with him, whereby he himself should become King of England, and Harold Earl of the whole splendid province of Wessex, being assured thereof, and linked to the king by marriage with William's daughter. All this story is told with irresistible charm in the tapestry chronicle of the reign, commonly attributed to William's wife, Queen Matilda, but actually designed by English artists under the guidance of his half-brother Odo, Bishop of Bayeux. It is, of course, the Norman version, and was for generations proclaimed by their historians as a full justification, and already even in those days aggressors needed justifications, of William's invasion of England. The Saxons contended that this was mere Norman propaganda, and there is the usual conflict of evidence. It is probable, however, that Harold swore a solemn oath to William to renounce all rights or designs upon the English crown, and it's likely that if he had not done so, he might never have seen either crown or England again. The feudal significance of this oath, making Harold William's man, was enhanced by a trick novel to those times, yet adapted to their mentality. Under the altar or table upon which Harold swore, there was concealed a sacred relic, said by some later writers to have been some of the bones of St. Edmund. An oath thus reinforced had a triple sanctity, well recognized throughout Christendom. It was a super oath, and the obligation, although taken unbeknown, was nonetheless binding upon Harold. Nevertheless, it cannot be said that the bargain between the two men was unreasonable, and Harold probably at the time saw good prospects in it for himself. By this time, William had consolidated his position at home. He destroyed the revolting armies of his rivals and ambitious relations. He had stabilized his western frontier against Brittany, and in the southwest he'd conquered Maine from the most powerful of the ruling houses of northern France, the Angevins. He'd forced the powers in Paris, who'd protected his youth, to respect his manhood. And by his marriage with Matilda, daughter of the Count of Flanders, he'd acquired a useful ally on his eastern flank. Meanwhile, Harold, liberated, was conducting the government of England with genuine acceptance and increasing success. At length, in January 1066, Edward the Confessor died, absolved, we trust, from such worldly sins as he'd been tempted to commit. With his dying breath, in spite of his alleged promise to William, he's supposed to have commended Harold, his young, valiant counsellor and guide, as the best choice for the crown which the Witan, or council, could make. At any rate, Harold, at the beginning of the fateful year, 1066, was blithely accepted by London, the Midlands, and the South, and crowned king with all solemnity in Westminster Abbey. This event opened again the gates of war. There'd been a precedent in France of a non-royal personage, Hugh Capet, becoming king, but this had been strongly resented by the nobility, whose pride, common ideas, and sentiments were increasingly giving the law to Western Europe. Every aspiring thane who heard the news of Harold's elevation was conscious of an affront, and also of the wide ranges open to ability and the sword. Moreover, the entire structure of the feudal world rested upon the sanctity of oaths. Against the breakers of oaths, the censures both of chivalry and the church were combined with blasting force. It was a further misfortune for Harold that Stigand, the Archbishop of Canterbury, had himself received the pallium from a schismatic pope. Rome, therefore, could not recognize Harold as king. At this very moment, the Almighty, reaching down from his heavenly sphere, made an ambiguous gesture. The tailed comet, or hairy star, which appeared at the time of Harold's coronation, is now identified by astronomers as Halley's Comet, which had previously heralded the nativity of our Lord. And it is evident that this example of divine economy in the movements for mundane purposes of celestial bodies might have been turned by deft interpretation to Harold's advantage. But the conquerors have told the tale, and in their eyes this portent conveyed to men the approaching downfall of a sacrilegious upstart. Two rival projects of invasion were speedily prepared. The first was from Scandinavia. The successors of Canute in Norway determined to revive their traditions of English sovereignty. An expedition was already being organised when Tostig, Harald's exiled and revengeful half-brother, ousted from his earldom of Northumbria, arrived with full accounts of the crisis in the island and of the weak state of its defences. King Harald Hardrada set forth to conquer the English crown. He sailed at first to the Orkneys, gathering recruits from the Scottish Isles and from the Isle of Man. With Tostig, he wended towards the northeast coast of England with a large fleet and army in the late summer of 1066. Harald of England was thus faced with a double invasion, from the northeast and from the south. In September 1066, he heard that a Norwegian fleet, with Hardrada and Tostig on board, had sailed up the Humber, beaten the local levies under Earls Edwin and Morcar, and encamped near York at Stamford Bridge. He now showed the fighting qualities he possessed. The news reached him in London, where he was waiting to see which invasion would strike him first and where. At the head of his Danish household troops, he hastened northwards up the Roman road to York, calling out the local levies as he went. His rapidity of movement took the northern invaders completely by surprise. Within 5 days of the defeat of Edwin and Morcar, Harald reached York, and the same day marched to confront the Norwegian army 10 miles from the city. The battle began. The Englishmen charged, but at first the Norsemen, though without their armour, kept their battle array. After a while, deceived by what proved to be a feint, the common ruse of those days, they opened up their shield rampart and advanced from all sides. This was the moment for which Harald had waited. The greatest crash of weapons arose. Hardrada was hit by an arrow in the throat, and Tostig, assuming the command, took his stand by the banner Land Ravager. In this pause, Harald offered his brother peace and also quarter to all Norsemen who were still alive. But the Norsemen called out all of them together that they would rather fall one across the other than accept of quarter from the Englishmen. Harald's valiant housecarls, themselves of Viking blood, charged home, and with a war shout, the battle began again. At this moment, a force left on board ship arrived to succour the invaders. They, unlike their comrades, were clad in proof, but breathless and exhausted from their hurried march, they cast aside their ringmail, threw in their lot with their hard-pressed friends, and nearly all were killed. The victorious Harald buried Hardrada in the 7 feet of English earth he'd scornfully promised him. But he spared his son Olaf and let him go in peace with his surviving adherents. Tostig paid for his restless malice with his life. Though the Battle of Stamford Bridge has been overshadowed by Hastings, it has a claim to be regarded as one of the decisive contests of English history. Never again was a Scandinavian army able seriously to threaten the power of an English king or the unity of the realm. At the moment of victory, news reached the king from the south that William the Bastard had landed at Pevensey. William the Conqueror's invasion of England was planned like a business enterprise. The resources of Normandy were obviously unequal to the task, but the Duke's name was famous throughout the feudal world, and the idea of seizing